Good morning. It's great to be here. This is a really seminal moment for myself and my team in terms of really being able to show you what we've been working on and the culmination of our work for the last 3 or 4 years. And it really comes down to is like, how can we take your existing app model and evolve it to take advantage of the new capabilities and the new experiences that you're building and we're building? Really thinking about this presentation is like, well, what was the best way to do this? And evolution seemed to be the best way to do it. So So why evolve? And I was trying to get, it was like, well, why do we have to evolve? And this picture, which is of me and my son on top of a very tall building in Shanghai, walking on the outside, which I'd recommend if you're crazy. As you can see, he's the future. He's excited. I'm petrified. Evolution is a scary thing. Change is difficult, but it's exciting at the same time. And this picture kind of summed that up for me. And I really want to evolve to a better PowerPoint clicker. There we go. Okay, I'm going to stand here. It really is, why we're evolving is to build better solutions for your customers. And that's really what it's all about. The tech's great, but, we're here to make people's lives better. We all saw, I think we all aspire to be able to create an Emma bracelet. And how do we do that and ensure that that is going to build better solutions and address more customers? Is that we're all out there to try and, look at that. We've evolved to a better one, I hope. And embrace this ubiquitous computing world that we live in. It's like we have to build solutions that take advantage of all our devices. You saw Joe earlier on show a lot of the stuff we're talking about in Timeline and how Project Rome is building on that. And really want to get your customers to use your app more. We want them to be able to engage in places that make sense to them. Finally, we do actually want to make your lives easier as well. We can do this today, but it's really, really complex. And how can we simplify that and really take it back to its roots so we can make an app model that helps you concentrate on building on your solutions rather than having to do the glue code to get everything to work? So app model provides that solution. Evolution takes years. Okay, so what is an app model? This is how do you install your app? How do you store state? Where do you store state? How long does your app run for? What's the versioning story? How are you going to be able to deal with versions if you've got multiple devices? Well, if you're not all in sync, then how's that going to work? How do you integrate with the operating system? What if there's multiple operating systems? How do you integrate with those things? How do you integrate with other applications? How can you get people to build on your applications, which is good for them, is good for you, makes your solution more sticky? And what can your app do? The app model really, that's its fundamental of what you do. An operating system is great, it provides device drivers, but the app model is really what it's about in terms of being able to ensure that you can build great, great solutions. I'm going to love looking back at this video of me doing this. Getting your app to your users, I have all these great builds that are really not going to work too great here. Fundamentally is like we want to get across devices, but we have to be able to get the app to your users. So something which almost nobody knows about, Delta downloads. We've actually had this for years in Windows. But the ability to just download the updates, the changes that your application's made, vastly increases the likelihood of a user updating your application. We want to keep everything up to date. We don't want to have to download the app every single time. Streaming installs, something which we talked about earlier this year, with the ability for you to say, okay, well, look, here is the basics of my app. Once that is downloaded, then I can go ahead and start, and I'll continue downloading and installing additional information, but I know that the users can start using my application. And it's something which we've been really working on pretty significantly over the last 18 months, is being able to componentize your application, to be able to split it up into multiple parts. And when you think about applications, they're more than just a single executable. And think of Office, which is one of the reasons why we did this. It's like, well, look, Word, Excel, PowerPoint. Well, we know that those are all separate executables. A user doesn't really know that that is a separate executable. They don't necessarily know there's separate executables in Word and Excel in itself. So how can we componentize it up such that your user can choose which application or which part of your application to install and what makes sense for them, and then they can update later. So it's something that really makes a huge difference. Oh, it worked, look at that. But you know, that's great. We can have a more efficient pipeline. But we want to ensure that your apps really keep up to date no matter where they're coming from. So a common request is I want to be able to control updates. I want to be able to enforce updates before running the app. I want to be able to do that for the enterprise as well as beta, as well as the store. The store is awesome. It keeps me up to date. I can already query that. But the store is not going to be there for every single scenario. Store for Business is awesome. Totally recommend you try that. But for some enterprise distributions, or even for beta distribution when you're distributing amongst yourselves within the team, that doesn't really work too well. And you know, frankly, ClickOnce has been around for a while, and it did that. And that's one of the major feedbacks we got. It's like, well, you know, Apex is kind of cool, but wouldn't it be great if you could do kind of what ClickOnce does? Well, we're doing that now. So we're introducing self-updating apps for UWP so your Apex can do that, so that your Apex can be kept up to date. You get to keep in control when it updates. You can do that from any share, from any HTTP source. Obviously, it works from the store as well. So you get to have complete control. And our goal here is to replace ClickOnce. Now, it's kind of replacing one of your own babies, because ClickOnce is developed by my team. We still have, you know, we have a, the original ClickOnce developer is still on our team. He's in my office most days telling me how we should do better about that. So it's something we want to evolve our existing solutions and provide you with all the capabilities that you do today using our new mechanisms. So that's getting your application there. Now, that's great, and that applies to all UWP. But we also realize there is a huge amount of applications out there that exist today. And we introduced the Desktop Bridge, I think 2 years ago now, when we first started talking about it. We first released it back in the anniversary update and in the creators update. We've just done some significant work. But you know, we started out deliberately small. We wanted to test the market. We wanted to work with some key developers. Some of them are in the front row right now in terms of, you know, what can we do? Is it going to scale? Is it going to meet everybody's requirements? And, you know, we've been pleasantly surprised. We thought it was going to be good. We knew it was good. It's actually beyond our expectations in terms of the applications that it can bring. And so it was a key change to our message. Really, we want every Win32 app should use the Desktop Bridge. And quite often I get, well, why should I do that? I don't necessarily want to be in the store. Well, obviously, we want you to be in the store. It just makes your app better for everybody. So it, you know, it installs better. It's going to be, it's going to not mess up your PC. It's going to provide you with a whole bunch of analytics that you don't get. And if you go to the store, you get analytics. You also get the opportunity to go to a whole bunch of markets that you probably are not thinking about right now. So it provides you with a way to do that. Now, that's great. But the really killer reason why it's great for your app is it enables your app to run on Windows 10S. Windows 10S is a great step forward. It enables users to not worry about installing software. Now, we're lucky. We understand what's going on. But the average user is really concerned about, should I install this app from a relatively random website? Being able to get it from a trusted place is good for all of us in terms of it drives trust into the relationship with users, and hence they'll use your app more, they'll download it more. And Windows 10S is the first step to do that. And by doing it with Desktop Bridge, we're enabling you to go to Windows 10S. So, you know, what are some of the features? There was a Desktop Bridge session yesterday, it's online already, goes into a lot more detail than this. But one of the key things we wanted to be able to do was really delight users And we know that users are using Win32 apps today. And we want them to move. We want you to move. We want them to move to desktop bridge-based apps. So now you can do a smooth transition from your existing Win32 app to the desktop bridge. So you don't use, you're not asking users to uninstall. You can just update, and it will just take advantage of all the data that you had there before. And then when we think about that, there's really some lessons that we learned. You know, many apps convert really easily. And the reason why is, frankly, we did a pretty terrible job of naming some of our tech. We have this desktop app converter, which is a cool tool. But the feedback we got was like, well, are you going to convert my app? Are you changing my app? Well, in reality, we're not actually changing your app. The desktop app converter is converting your installer from MSI or whatever you use, maybe Xcopy, through to creating you an AppX. So you convert your installer, not your app. Your app pretty much runs exactly how it is today. All the capabilities it has today, it has tomorrow with the desktop bridge. So your app remains pretty much unchanged. Now, some apps do have what I would like to think really are bugs that, frankly, you probably shouldn't have been doing even on Windows 7. And the reason why this, you know, this can be a little bit challenging, but essentially the desktop bridge is enforcing the app model that we'd hoped, and we kind of hoped that people would do, but there was no enforcement. Desktop bridge is the first time to do that, and it does bring up some challenges. I mean, we've seen a number of apps that are going out there calling regexe to update the registry, and it's like, well, if you want to update the registry, there's a perfectly good API. Rather than spawning out to a regexe, why, you know, do the right thing. Think about where you're using your app. And if your app does admin elevation, really take a long, hard look at whether admin elevation is the right thing to do. Really, you probably shouldn't be doing that. I mean, obviously, there are some apps that require admin elevation, but most apps shouldn't. You don't want your users running as admin. That's going to be bad for them in the grand scheme of things. And then, you know, development lifecycle integration. We've been making great strides with Visual Studio. There's some great blogs and some NuGet packages coming from our team and working with Visual Studio to make that. The desktop app converter is getting better. But we're working with a bunch of third parties. Look at it, it worked. Either that or he pressed the button when I clicked. So, so we have new tooling options for you. So you can have a single setup package that produces AppX and MSI. All our partners here on here, they're providing solutions you can get today. This is not coming soon. These have already shipped. So if you use Flexera Install Shield, if you use Advanced Installer, FireGiant is the value add on top of Wix, Rad Studio and Installerware. These you're probably using something like this already, and it creates you a setup that just spits out an MSI for Windows 7 and it spits out an AppX for Windows 10. And this is a key point, is that for most applications, your app can continue targeting Windows 7. We know that there are a lot of Windows 7 users out there, especially if you're an enterprise, although enterprises are moving to Windows 10 very quickly. So it means that you can have a single code base and have a huge addressable market. And that's really key. And we want to ensure, that's why we're working so closely with these partners. And frankly, they're doing things that we never imagined they would go do. So they're doing, you know, some of the stuff that Advanced Installer is doing. If you want to make the simplest way, they run it, you know, they run you in a Hyper-V and they basically track every change. You just have to run the setup package and an AppX comes out at the end of it. You have to know almost nothing about what's going on. So it's a really great tool. And likewise for Flexera and FireGiant, they really do a great job of that. The biggest question we get though is, why isn't Microsoft using the bridge? And it's a great question. Why aren't we? Well, the good news is we are. Office is coming to the store. You saw that at the when we announced Windows 10S. I'm actually running PowerPoint. I've been running Office on Centennial probably for, I don't know, about 14 months now. It's a lot better than it was 14 months ago, so it's easier to do now. But you know, internally, we're self-hosting that, and you'll be able to self-host that too soon. And on the insiders, well, Windows 10S is coming in preview, and general availability will come later. And likewise with Microsoft Teams, we're also working very closely with them. The Microsoft Teams will be coming to the store as well soon. So you know, the desktop bridge provides you a great way to get your existing application onto Windows 10 using a lot of the new technologies. And it provides you just a great experience for a, just a better installer. How many of you actually want to write an installation package? Hopefully I didn't see it. Surprisingly, not so many. Now, I'm a little scared because my deployment team is at the front. They didn't put their hands up. But so it'll be interesting at review time this year. So, but this is bringing your app, because, and then it's like, well, okay, so I have a better installer. What can I do? And that's really where we've been working over the last, really, 3 or 4 years to how do we build this app model that takes advantage of the Microsoft Graph. When we started, the Microsoft Graph didn't even exist as a name. But it's, you know, it's enriching the Microsoft Graph so that everybody can make better apps. So when we were evolving to the graph-based app model, the key thing here is today the app model is pretty much client-based, but we live in this multi-device world. And the Microsoft Graph is really there to allow you to start interconnecting. And today, there's some APIs that, frankly, my team ships, and it's a good example of that, is that, you know, in the app model today, we have a contacts, calendar, email, messages, APIs. And in the graph, there's contacts, calendar, email, and messages. Now, there is a fair amount of crossover there, which was kind of serendipitous. It wasn't actually, you know, we weren't working as well together as we could. But there's some kind of crazy things there. As I can send an email from the Microsoft Graph APIs, but I can't from the client app model APIs. Clearly, this is not a good idea. So we want to ensure that the graph and the client APIs come together. We want it to be seamless. You shouldn't have to choose one API over another because there happens to be a different capability on is essentially the same API, depending on where you're calling it from. Now, the first thing we're going to do here is thinking about how we can get your apps and how can we enrich the graph with your applications. So this is going to be tough. Let's try this one. OK. So the Microsoft Graph today, and with the Creators Update, is actually will store the data about your applications and your devices using either your MSA or your AAD. I really wish I hadn't built builds in my slides now. If we can get it to show up here, then I can get it to work. So, you know, if I use my Windows PC to get an app into the Windows Store today, the graph is being updated, saying, "Hey, look!" And you already see that if you go to the Windows Store, it has your library, and it's like we already have this storage, but that's just on Windows. Once the graph knows that I've got, in this case, Teams, then it should be smart enough to go, well, shoot, you've got an iPhone, you've got an Android phone, you've got another PC. Well, I need to be able to ensure that you get those applications, if you want to, the user's always in control, and get those applications and cause them to be installed on those devices. Now, obviously, on the Windows and anything using from the Microsoft ecosystem, clearly we own everything, but We know how to get that done from Android. We know how to get that from Apple, too, to get those applications to be installed for the users. So it's really there to help with engagement. Engagement is great, but you have to make sure that users know how to go get your application. And how can that be seamless? Telling a user is like, well, I'm going to text you a link. We've all seen those. It was like, well, that's a solution. It's just not a solution we want. We want it to just work. But in order to be able to send my applications, I need to have a device graph. So we're adding devices to the Microsoft Graph. That's happening today. You saw that with some of Joe's stuff earlier. And this is starting to drive the timeline experience, the pick up where I left off. You have to know what devices a user has. So when we know those devices, it provides status and signaling so that I can actually call features. I can call applications on my devices. Again, because we care about enterprise and consumer, we support MSA and AAD, so that you might have some devices that are only available to your AAD, and you don't want them to be available for MSA and vice versa. And the key thing here, and this has been something we've been driving for a long time, is the URL is the key programming construct here. you are going to communicate with applications and devices via a URL. So there's some examples at the bottom in terms of, you know, I can be able to go to graph.microsoft.com, whack me, whack devices, and it will show me all my devices. But what does this mean to your app? Oops. It transforms your app into a service. Just by, because you expose, if you expose your app with a custom scheme, with a URL, and you've got the device graph, and all of a sudden, you can build solutions and enable other applications to build solutions utilizing your app across multiple devices. So for example, if I'm filling out an expense report, which I will be, although luckily we're in Seattle, so I don't have to do that much, is I fill out an expense report, and one of the first thing it says is like, well, do you have a picture of that receipt? And, you know, because it's a UWP, it's like, well, there's a camera on my Surface Book. It's like, well, sure, I'll try and take a photo of my camera, on my camera. But I'm stood there in front of my PC. The camera is, for taking a picture of my receipt, is not a great experience. But by using the power of the device graph and the app graph, then that expense report can know that my phone in my pocket probably has a great camera. So go and find me the best device with the best camera. So I can, you know, my phone will buzz, I can pick it up, the camera pops up, I either take a photo or I can pick it from the photo library, and it automatically does it. Thinking about how users want it to work. So let's try a demo of some of this. So what I wanted to show you first of all was really, you know, a pretty boring demo in terms of how does the graph actually work. So here, many of you are familiar with Postman. And here I have, if you notice on my URL, I have graph.microsoft.com, it's in beta, me, WAC devices, and then I have some access token, which is really the access token that came from me logging on with, in this case, my MSA. And I can just hit send. Didn't work. But fear not. I will get a new access token. And use that token. And let's see if it runs. And it worked. Okay. All right. So it's real. You know, real code is, now, unfortunately, real code means also we have bugs. So if you see here, I have, it's bringing back, you know, here's my desktop back at work, but here's my Surface Book. And you'll see it's starting to show me some information about that particular device. Now, this is great and all, so like, this is cool, but so now I know that I have this Surface Book. How do I actually send a command to it? So here I have, I'm just going to say, you know, graph.microsoft.com, whack devices. And then further down that URI, I'm basically just going to post some JSON. And I say, OK, I want to launch a URI. And in this case, I'm going to try and Skype my wife. Luckily, I know she's not listening right now. So, but let's try it. So I can click send here. And the authentication failed again. Look at that. Get a new access. Let's do this one. Use the token, and I'm going to hit send, and then hopefully here comes Skype, and I'm now calling a method on Skype to go call my wife. Now I'm not going to call my wife. I don't think she'd appreciate that right now. But you know, the key thing is this could be your application. But I mean, that's cool, and I can do it from a graph. So any REST endpoint can start to do that. With the user's permission, of course. You have to authenticate against that and allow the user to do it. But probably want to do it from a device. So my trusty iPhone here, I have the Roman app, which is in the store. And this one is actually showing me, and this one doesn't have a bug, so the graph has a bug right now. Here's all my devices that I currently have. So my Surface Book, the desktop you saw, but my two Xboxes at home. Because my kids fight about Xboxes, so they have, and my iPhone. And I can go on here. Now I'm just going to launch a URI on this. Now hopefully Bing.com comes up. And I can now start. Now, of course, I could have called Skype. But the beauty of this is now once I have the device graph, I can get everything working. I can start to call functionality between devices. I heard a little bit of applause. So wouldn't it be great if we had a remote control that worked with a PC? There we go, okay. So that enables you to have devices and apps in the graph. But then when you think about it, we want to know what the user's doing. We want to be able to provide a richer way for users to really understand what they've been doing and where they should be going. You saw earlier Joe announced the Windows timeline. We're super excited about that. The activity graph is powering all that. Think of this as the engine that is powering the timeline. Notification mirroring, which some of you are already using, we shipped last year. Pick up where I left off. You saw that in Joe's, so that I can start something on my phone and finish it on my PC. Abelardo showed that as well. And then the cloud-powered clipboard. The activity graph is the way that all is going to enable all of these things. So think of it as basically it's storing all the pieces of activity, the units of activity that your users are doing in that. And that's where timeline is basically visualizing all of those activities, but no matter what from which device. And you can create and read activities for your application. And this is really the key here. Now, we'll provide some information in terms of your app started and your app finished. But you want, really for users, you want to be able to provide a richer capability of being able to do that. So, you know, for example, I think Joe showed in PowerPoint, it was like the fact that I opened this specific presentation and I was on slide 33, that's the type of thing you want to add to the activity feed. And the key thing about the activity feed, again, is available from the Microsoft Graph because it is part of the Microsoft Graph. Remember us saying that URI is essentially the programming construct for this? You can always get to it via that. Of course, we provide you SDKs on the client. And activity feed is great, but you have to be able to visualize that. How can you actually drive engagement? A database is not going to drive engagement. The activity feed essentially is a database of your life. It stores all that information for you. But you have to be able to drive engagement by providing some user experience. And you know, engagement is a common goal for all of us. If you're a commercial software, then obviously you want people using your app more. But frankly, even if it's a line of business, you want people to be able to engage with your app and be more productive, more quicker. So, and we believe the activities are the record of engagement. And you know, some examples of this are a new clicker. The song position that I'm listening to, the web page scroll, where I was, the Word document page. Notifications, which we already have, notifications are probably the most personal message you can get. If I want to send a message to Raphael, then I'm going to send him a notification. That's going to get it. Now, of course, I could send him an email and he'll ignore it, but if I send him a Twitter, then he's going to go get that. But you know, even thinking about line of business, the order status, you know, these are types of things you're going to store in the activity feed. And adaptive cards are the way to provide a visual for those engagements. We've been working on adaptive cards for actually not that long, but it feels like years. But the key thing of adaptive cards are really building on the kind of the rich history that we've had with tiles and notifications, and learning from you and working closely with you is that how can we build a better solution that provides flexibility, but also enable for you as the card provider, but also works within the host environment, be that, you know, maybe it's a bot, maybe it's the timeline. You want to be able to take advantage of that. So an activity may contain a card, but it doesn't have to. For example, the groove music track position, it doesn't really matter that you don't really necessarily want to visualize that. You just want to go to that next time you're in groove. Okay, but cards are used in more than just an activity. This is the key, is that you start using adaptive cards. They're available to you no matter where you want to engage with the users. Yes, it works great with Activity Feed, and it's a great way for you to get through the timeline. But, you know, if you want to build a bot, then using adaptive cards are available in throughout the bot framework. You saw with Slack and Kick, there's a bunch of surfaces that you can do. Use the exact same card, so you'll be able to use it as a tile, as a toast, timeline, as a bot. You'll be able to do that, and you can use it inside of your own application too. We're providing standard renderers for the adaptive cards in both, you know, XAML and for UWP, but also HTML, iOS, Android, and you can even speak it. It doesn't think about how you're going to get engagement. But, you know, when cards and activities are used together, that's where we believe there's really the magic. And that really the magic we believe here is in timeline. So, you know, here's an example timeline, some questionable music choices. But, you know, look on the top right in terms of Microsoft Teams. So, you know, we created the card, we're publishing some schema. I really wish this would work right now. So I have my activity, which is kind of behind all that, but my card is visualizing the whole situation for me. So when I look at that, so there's metadata for that, the URI, the visual. But I can take that exact same card and I could put it into a bot framework. You think about it from a team's perspective. I'm going to click it, you're going to see it in the timeline. I'm probably going to send it as a message. Well, I want to be able to do that, and then I want to be able to provide more information that is specific to the bot framework, so the routing info, the channel info, and maybe even the attachments. But the key thing is here, I have a standard format that will work in lots of different places, and you don't have to worry about that. You have to worry about how you want to visualize your data, and it will apply to wherever it needs to go. So it ends up that same thing, moved from the timeline all the way through into the bot. And you notice it looks different in the bot, because you know the way that a bot wants to show it and the way that a timeline wants to show it, it will be different. I mean, you see this already today with tiles and toast notifications. It needs to be able to adapt to the host environment. The best way to show this, though, because I have a clicker that doesn't really work, is to show a demo. Did that come up? It did. Okay. All right, so here's the tile visualizer, which is available on adaptive cards.io today. You can go do this. It's actually running live. So here I have, you know, a card that's actually showing some airline information, seeing it in Skype. But, you know, what does that look like? What would it look like in Teams? Teams is a little bit more of a document-centric thing. I want to change that. But, you know, what would it look like in Bing? The key thing here is I get to provide the information, and I get to have some control, and I'm working within the host environment. But really, when it all pulls together, how does that pull together with the graph and visualization? So my team is obviously fairly clear that they want to show me on top of a building looking scared, so this is me. And I click on this, and here's visualizing, is calling out to the Microsoft graph, and here's all those devices that we saw before. And you know, I'm going to look at what I was doing on my desktop, and here's the activities that were on that particular desktop. And, you know, well, Seattle weather is 60 degrees, what a surprise. And so I can click on that, and there's my in this Explorer, this is really designed for you to go look at it. This isn't an end user feature. But here's my card, but then provides me with a look at all the JSON for that card, and I'll be able to update that. And the key thing here is no matter where you get to do it, you can build this. This application is not using any specific Microsoft tech. You can do all of this in your own applications. You can take advantage of adaptive cards. You can take advantage of the activity feed within that. So what does this mean for me? The key thing we want you to be able to do is to write to the activity feed today. If you write to the activity feed today, one, you can query it and you can actually track what your applications are using. But you know, when Timeline comes out, then automatically your application will show up in Timeline. People will engage with it more. There's probably the prime real estate in terms of Windows, being able to take advantage of that information. And really, that's the key to everything. So that if you're going to take away one thing, is write to the activity feed. And build adaptive cards to visualize and drive engagement. Many of you are already doing this today with Toast and Tiles. You can build on that. And you know, one of the key pieces of the feedback we got from Toast and Tiles is like, XML is cool and all, but like JSON's really where it's at. I don't want to have to translate from JSON to XML. So we're bringing that and making our entire platform better. And then the Roam APIs really enable you to transform your app into a service such that you can really start to enable apps and users to engage with your application more and use it more effectively. Now, that's fine from just a Roam perspective, but think about what it means for an app model today is that we want every app developer to go use a desktop bridge for your existing Windows app. If you're already on UWP, then great. You're already ahead of the game. We want you to use the desktop bridge. We want you to cross that bridge. The goal there is to help it, to make it easier for you to get to UWP. But we want your applications, it's a very squeaky stage. We want your applications to get there using the desktop bridge so users can start using your app wherever they are. The deployment improvements are going to apply to everybody who either on the desktop bridge or UWP. With the application graph, we believe this is really going to drive adoption. And it's going to drive users getting your applications quicker and staying up to date. And staying up to date is the most important thing to do. That we all live that particular nightmare where your user's on an older version and they can't update. They don't know what they didn't even know there was a newer version. So we want to ensure that you can always keep your users up to date. And then finally, the graphs and adaptive cards really, really provides you with a great way to visualize and to engage with your users. And Project Roam provides you with a whole bunch of SDK APIs to make it even simpler for you to do. And today you saw Abelardo announce that the Roam SDK is available in iOS. We're super excited about that. It's available on iOS and Android and Windows today. And of course, the Microsoft Graph is available to everybody. It's a REST API. But the key thing here is it's a consistent API across all those so that there's one mechanism for you to drive engagement and to make your applications better. So that's really why we want you to, why we're evolving the app model, to ensure that your applications can really take the step forward. And we wanted to make sure you didn't have to rewrite everything. You can take small steps into this. Like, right into the activity feed, as Abelardo showed earlier, it's a couple of lines of code. You really don't have to do much. But you gain a whole bunch of benefit today, and you'll gain more benefit tomorrow. So that's really our call to action is, bring your applications forward. Desktop Bridge is going to help you. And then the Roam SDK and our graph-based app model is really helping you take a step forward to the future. So when we think about that, there's a whole bunch of information that's going into a lot more detail than I can do in my kind of 40 minutes here. So first one, the Desktop Bridge actually happened yesterday. That's available. Vikas and Carmen from my team will be going really in-depth in terms of what Roam means. And then finally, Sean will be really looking at, if you really want to know about what it takes from an activity feed, go do that. Now, they're later today. I think actually Vikas is pretty much after this one. And then Sean later today. And then, this one I'm actually pretty excited about. Is Stefan and Ginny. Ginny is one of our MVPs. We love our MVPs, is really trying to kind of essentially bust a bunch of myths in terms of, can you actually build a great desktop app using UWP today? I'm sure a bunch of you are out there going, well, no, you can't. And the goal there really is to sit down and look at the things that are coming in the full creators update, and frankly, some of the features are there today that people don't know about, and build some really great applications. Now, I'm hoping to get a beer from Morton on this one, so I'm looking forward to this one for two reasons. And then, you know, adaptive cards, Matt is going to be talking really in depth exactly what adaptive cards can do for you and how you can take advantage of it in your applications today. And then finally, John and Sandeep from Apex deployment team, they're really going into a lot of the detail in terms of, you know, some of the things which I alluded to in terms of, you know, the app distribution with streaming, being able to componentize your application, but also to ensure the self-updating. And they got a couple of surprises that I'm not going to ruin for them. So, but if you're a Contoso fan, I recommend that you go to John's session because, you know, I think Contoso lost a little bit of the limelight today, you know. So, you know, Contoso's coming back. We're saving that till Friday because, you know, Contoso's that good. So the key thing here is there's a whole bunch of information. We're really trying hard to do a better job of reaching out. So, for example, the Desktop Bridge team have a whole day's worth of training available online. They'll take you from kind of soup to nuts of knowing everything about Desktop Bridge. And, you know, my ask to you, other than the calls to action, is we want to hear your feedback. We really, really do. You know, if you saw, hopefully, earlier this year, we're publishing our backlog. It's like, so that we're trying to be as open as we possibly can and be able to ensure that we're building the right solutions for you. So, you know, please converse with us, Twitter, use a voice. We're more than happy. Andrew Klinik is my Twitter handle. It's at the front of my session. We really, really want to hear from you. We want to reach out. So thank you for coming, and I'm happy to take questions. So if you do have questions, then use the microphones because we're broadcasting live. They won't hear you otherwise, so no pressure.
Yeah, a question about a Windows S. So it only supports the UWP program. Desktop is out of the question, is that right?
So Windows S, I think to repeat the question, does Windows S only support UWP? No. Windows S has a code integrity policy that says it can run any application as long as it comes from the store. So it has to come from the store, which is why the Desktop Bridge is so important in terms of, if it's signed by the store, then it will run. Now, obviously, UWP is a large part of that, but we want to ensure that your existing applications can come to the store as well, and the Desktop Bridge is the key on that.
Okay, thank you.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a question about where do you store the graph, the Windows graph, the Office graph, the mega graph that we get now?
Yeah, so the question is, where do we store essentially all the data for the graph? Now, that's a complex answer on this. It depends where you are, frankly. Like, for example, if you're in Germany, then there are very specific requirements that data for Germany has to be in Germany. And likewise, you know, we want, you know, if you're from the US, then your data should be in the US. So it depends on the geographic where you are. The beauty of the graph, there isn't one big service for the graph. But think of the graph as a way to essentially synthesize a whole bunch of Microsoft services, and potentially services from you too. We can do service-to-service integration on that, but providing a common programming model that you can plug into. So, you know, the graph is kind of everywhere in terms of wherever Microsoft's cloud is. So there's no really one answer. Does that make sense?
So my second question is, will I have to pay as the size of my graph grows?
The question was, will I have to pay as the size of my graph grows? And that really depends. So, for example, the activity feed, no. There's no charge for that. There is a limit to how much data you can store per activity feed unit. But, for example, OneDrive is part of the Microsoft graph. Now, you get so much free. And if you're an Office 365 user, you get, I think, a terabyte. In some parts of the graph, it's a pay for usage. Don't forget, also, Exchange is part of the Microsoft graph as well. And obviously, there's a consumer experience where you get however much you get there, but you know, your Office 365, your Exchange that you're using in your company, it depends on what you're using and how much you've signed up to use. typically there is a free tier that you get a certain amount of for everything. But things like activity feed or notifications mirroring, there is no charge for the user on that. But the graph, I think the key thing to remember here is the graph is not just a data store for all your data. So if you're going to, if you want to store application state, then you need to think about where that's going to get stored and how much that, you know, Azure is still, you know, a great place to go do that, and you saw some of the intelligent edge, so you can actually have that closer to you. The great thing about intelligent edge, it provides you with more flexibility about where you want to pay for essentially your storage. If you have a whole bunch of storage locally and you believe that's the right place for you to do it, then you should be able to use that and have the same programming model. So it's up to you where you want to do it.
Okay, so it's part of my OneDrive, like the current UWP.
No, the OneDrive is essentially like a file store in the cloud. So it's another hard drive, essentially.
Yes,
the activity feed is not part of OneDrive. Think of the activity feed as a database that you have an API on, but it doesn't show up in your OneDrive.
Yes, but OneDrive was used by Microsoft to store part of my UWP, like roaming stuff.
So, yes, OneDrive is used to store some of your roaming data. And you'll see, and I'm not sure if there's a session on roaming data, is that, you know, we're providing a more flexible mechanism to do that. For example, if you're writing an enterprise app, you probably don't want your data to roam to somebody's OneDrive. You want it to maybe roam to your own thing or to, you know, the OneDrive for business. So you get more flexibility to do that. So you as a developer get to choose, and you as a user get to choose where you're going to store data.
Okay, thanks.
Okay.
Can you rewrite the activity feed? So let's say you write an activity to the Office graph, and the user performs some other activities. Can you go back and rewrite the history?
Can you edit? So you have read-write to your own activities.
Okay.
So whatever your app was writing, then you get to control over that. Now you wouldn't be able to. You might be able to read some of my activities depending on what I wanted to make public. You probably wouldn't have read-write access to my app's activities. But yes, you can. You get control over your own activities.
And you can write as many activities in the feed as you can, as you want?
Yes. Now, there's a question, we're still adjusting the dial on that, is like, how big can a particular activity be? One of the things we are finding talking to customers is like, well, I'm gonna, you know, I want my activity to be like, you know, 100 megabytes. You know, like, well, that's not really what it's aimed to do. If you want to store something, frankly, probably, in the hundreds of K, then you should probably store that wherever you want to store it. Maybe it's OneDrive, maybe it's your own. And then you provide a URI to that in the activity. So think of the activity as almost kind of breadcrumbs in terms of breadcrumb trail of what you've been doing, but not actually storing the content itself.
Thank you.
Hi, I have an app that has a Win32 app that has a service that needs to run as local system to, like, control cameras, disable, enable, or do content filtering by examining URLs with Windows filtering platform.
Yep.
And it's specifically for education,
mm-hmm.
Which is kind of what Windows 10S is for. So
yep.
I'm not sure how I would tackle that.
Yeah. So the desktop bridge specifically and by design doesn't allow services right now. And we don't believe that we'll ever enable services. Not that services are bad. I mean, clearly you're writing a great service, I'm sure. But in terms of being able to update, you think of being able to update a service, as you no doubt are aware, is difficult to do. And what we're doing is we're really working on the app model to ensure that a lot of the scenarios that you use a service for today will provide with long-running tasks to move that out. Because the challenge with services today is that they can do everything. There is essentially no security. So writing a good service is really quite difficult to do. And being able to update a service from a store mechanism, again, is because the store should be able to update without having to reboot a machine. Updating a service and without elevating, because the last thing you want to do is come in at, you know, 8 o'clock in the morning, you just see a UAC, and you don't know actually what's going on. That's why we're highly encouraging people to move out from away from services into long-running tasks, be them Win32 or UWP. But we do realize that some applications do require services and you know won't work without services. And right now, the desktop bridge doesn't enable that. So I'm happy to talk to you about like the things that you might want to go do and the opportunities that you know the long-running tasks can do.
Right, Microsoft could move the support we need into the UWP.
Right, and so that's really exactly the question that we're asking. It's like, okay, well, the things that you're trying to do in the service today, often, I'm not sure about your case, often is frankly because we didn't have the right extension points in the operating system. So you had to not to be too polite, hack around some of the inadequacies of our extension points. So we want to provide the extension points such that they can go do that. A good example, which is related to this, is print drivers. Now, obviously, like there are print drivers that actually talk to printers, but a whole bunch of print drivers are really just software, just wanting to fit into an extensibility point. So print to PDF is a great example of that. We're working closely with the print driver teams and you know folks who do print to PDF to ensure that you can hook into that extension point, i.e. the print, wherever print is, but it would actually call your application, but not run as a driver. Run, frankly, as just a software, as it should be. So our goal there is to open up the operating system more so that you don't have to write services and drivers.
Is there some place to like submit requirements?
Yes. So there is on the fourth floor. There's a desktop bridge area. That's probably the best place to go do it. The team is right in front of you right now. So I would heartily recommend you talk to them and me. Right. So.
Thank you.
You've brought up a topic now that has me interested, and I'm not sure that this is the right forum for it. It may be a complete tangent, but you talk about long-running tasks, and to be honest, this is the first I've run into them, and we also have services. Do long-running tasks survive logouts, logins? Do they start when the operating system starts?
Long-running tasks start, they're user-based. So they do. It's one of the key differences between services and long-running tasks. They don't run when the user is not logged in.
So that really takes away from they're not really an equivalent or a replacement for service.
It depends what in the entirety of services, absolutely not. But a lot of times people are writing services that frankly probably shouldn't have been services, so they wouldn't even be using that. Now, we do want to take your requirements in terms of what you need to do that is running without the user. Right now, from the store, we're deliberately focusing on updating applications that are on a user basis such that we don't enable, frankly, some of the problems that are out there right now is an application can install whatever it wants and users get thoroughly confused and honestly the bad guys are taking advantage of that. And we're trying to provide an app model that is specifically focused on apps, but we do want to provide extensibility points such that the things that you're doing with services today, you'll be able to move to a more app-based focus.
But services in the current context are completely agnostic to the user, to the user's login and so on, and it's hard for me to imagine that a store app will ever get there.
Brutally frank, there are some applications, if your application 100% requires a service is useless without it, then that's not a good fit for the desktop bridge currently. Most of the consumer applications and a lot of line of business applications don't require services, but there are a class that absolutely requires services and they're perfectly fine apps. They should continue. If you require a service, then you should continue using the mechanisms that you do that. I do realize that on Windows 10S that does restrict you. And there are restrictions on what you can do in Windows 10S.
Good enough, thanks.
Yeah. Just to extend on that a little bit, you said that the long-running tasks would be restricted to the user login itself, but how about the lifetime of the UWP app that launched that long-running task?
I think you're asking, is the background task limited to the lifetime of the UWP? And no, it's not. It can continue running. And it does depend. There are some hardware restrictions potentially. On desktop, that's essentially there isn't any because you know, the hardware. But you know, at some point, maybe if you're running on a laptop and the battery was getting real low, then the operating system would try and clean up background tasks before it cleaned up foreground tasks. But if you're plugged in or even on decent battery, then essentially your task can continue running as long as it wants.
Grant, thanks.
And I think, Stefan, are you covering that in your session?
Not in detail.
Okay. There's a pre-recorded talk that goes over. It's honestly it is kind of one of the myths, right? Nobody really understands how our background tasks work, and we need to do a better job of explaining that. And you know, the show that I think Chris did. There's a half an hour talk. It's probably up already. We'll find out the link to you. So.
Hi, just kind of going off the existing theme of like system and like system level tasks. Do you see like a long-term vision to like, I guess, bring system-level tests into this type of new modern app model in some form or fashion?
Not really. So if you're doing system-level software, then the app model that we're providing right now is specifically designed not to do that. Not that we don't believe that that's important. We do believe that's important, but we want to provide a solution that. For the vast majority of applications, be they consumer or enterprise, provide a way that is trustworthy, we can update, we can keep up to date, we can ensure they continue running on newer versions of Windows and different versions of Windows as you think about things like Surface Hub or you saw the HoloLens today. If you're writing system software, which is super cool, we know that we totally want to enable that. Is the existing mechanisms to do that are going to continue on desktop to ensure that. But we're not going to bring that to the app model because, to be perfectly honest, is if we did, then our ability to ensure that trust was there for the vast majority of applications almost goes away. Because as soon as I can install a driver or a service, then we essentially can't control what that does. And that's by design, right? You want the service and the driver to be able to do things that a normal application shouldn't be able to go do. And we don't want to restrict what a service and the driver can go do because we need that system-level software to go do it. But so, for example, like if you're an antivirus provider, then the desktop bridge and the store are not the place to go do that.
Okay.
It's not antivirus per se, but that type of...
Yeah.
Thing that you're going to go do. Yeah.
Okay, so we should be confident that we will have that ability, I guess, at least for the near future or long term.
Yeah, look, if you're existing on, Windows 10S is a new beast, and is there to, that is just store only on Windows 10S. But on desktop, all your existing mechanism to do that will work. The challenge is, honestly, is thinking about whether your users are going to accept a UAC prompt to install your app. Increasingly, we're seeing that people don't want to do that because they're really scared as to what that actually means. And their kind of default answer is no. And and the same thing for self-updating apps, they're using their own updaters in Windows. One of the reasons why we're doing it in AppX, self-updating, is that users have become attuned to that is bad. And software that does that, whilst it might not be bad, they don't know what to do, so they don't do it. So what we're trying to do is build a trustworthy system that you can explain to a normal user, and it's like, okay, you install this thing, life's going to be okay. And it's pretty powerful, but there are limitations on that because we want people installing and updating the software way more often than they are today.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, because we're live, I think we have 2 minutes left. So thank you for coming. I appreciate it. And enjoy the rest of the build.